This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. A research study conducted by the Women's Aid Organization suggests that there is an urgent need to increase the quantity and standards of domestic violence shelters in Selangor. So international best practices recommend a minimum of one family place in a women's shelter per 10,000 people, but Malaysia only has an estimated one family place per 72,538 people. So there is a huge gap there. And joining me today is Tan Hyang Lee, an advocacy and communications officer at the Women's Aid Organization, to discuss the gaps in the system and also how NGOs and the government can work together better to ensure that domestic violence survivors get the assistance and protection that they need. Welcome, Hyang Lee. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. Always good to have you on the show. So, you know, Hyang Lee, we've often spoken about what women can do to escape domestic violence situations, right? Sometimes, of course, that involves life-threatening violence. But where do the survivors actually go if they have no one else to turn to?
It's very important that we have shelters available for domestic violence survivors. And one reason is that in a case of domestic violence, oftentimes an abuser may isolate a survivor from her support system. So an abuser may prohibit a survivor from keeping in regular contact with her family and friends. As a result, when a survivor wants to leave, she may find that she has nowhere to turn to. And also bearing in mind that the moment a survivor chooses to leave an abusive situation, it's oftentimes an incredibly dangerous situation for the survivor. I mean, just imagine if a survivor had often been under the control of an abuser. Mm-hmm. So the moment she tries to leave and get herself out of that situation, that's when an abusive partner will often try to reestablish control and he may threaten her. And that's why it's so critical for her to have a safe place to go to.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in Malaysia, we have the Domestic Violence Act 1994, correct? And that defines both what a shelter is and it also defines what a safe place is. I mean, are they different? I mean, could you help us understand those terms better?
Under the Domestic Violence Act, a safe place is defined as a home or institution that is maintained or managed by the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, or the Social Welfare Department, or JKM, or is a place that is approved by the ministry, meaning that if it's a NGO-run shelter, this shelter is approved by the ministry. And in contrast, a shelter is basically any home, institution, or any other suitable place in which the owner or occupier is willing to temporarily receive a victim or survivor. So the definition for shelter is more open, and it could even include, say, if you choose to open your doors to a survivor, this could include, this would fall under the definition of a shelter.
Okay, so basically all safe places are shelters, but not all shelters are designated safe places under the DVA, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So essentially safe places are places that are run by the government or approved by the government for housing a domestic violence survivor.
Okay, all right. And, you know, like you said, you know, shelters, they are a lifeline for so many survivors, right? And I imagine that every shelter and safe housing as well, you know, the programs are different. But let's say I'm somebody who is who has finally left that situation, that domestic violence situation. What can I generally expect when I go to, you know, one of these places?
So the duration in which a survivor can stay in a shelter depends on each shelter's individual policy. And based on our research, so we basically went around and talked to operators of shelters in KL and Selangor. And we found that on average, these shelters allow survivors to stay there for a few days to a few months.
Okay.
So all except one shelter that we interviewed had no maximum or minimum length of stay, and one shelter had a maximum of 3 months. And in terms of whether you can bring your children, most survivors actually bring along their children to the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
But some shelters, they only accept boys up to 12 years or 14 years of age.
Okay. And so if you were in a situation where your son is older than that, would the boy be sent to another safe space as such, another a home perhaps?
So what happens is that a shelter may refer that family to another shelter that doesn't have those criteria, mm-hmm. or if they have, you know, two facilities within the space, they may house the boy in a separate facility within the same space.
Okay, all right. And am I correct in saying that, you know, securing safe shelter, that's one of the most crucial steps, you know, on the pathway to a survivor's long-term security?
Yeah, it's a very critical step for many survivors. Of course, there are some survivors who may have alternative arrangements. Mm-hmm. Say they have family members or friends whom they can stay with, or they're able to rent a place. But, you know, this is not something that's available to all survivors. So for many domestic violence survivors, having a shelter is especially critical. And also because a shelter is not just a roof over a woman's head.
Yeah.
You know, shelters are also where women can access a range of services from social work and getting, you know, empowerment programs and so on and so forth. And just to share an anecdote from one of the survivors we had supported, she says that, you know, for many domestic violence survivors, in her observation, she noticed that when they were in the shelter, it was the first time they could finally sleep in peace without fear for their safety. Because if you think about it, the moment when you are asleep is when you're most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So for many survivors, they're often in a state of perpetual vigilance. They're always looking over their shoulders for fear of what could happen next. So they basically don't get to sleep in peace in their own house. So being in a shelter is the first time they can sleep without fear.
Can actually be peaceful, right? Yep. To feel, oh gosh, that's so sad. And I mentioned some stats earlier, but how many shelters are there, you know, here in Malaysia? Do we actually have stats like that?
So in Malaysia, we have 43 shelters which are designated as safe places under the Domestic Violence Act. Of these 43 shelters, 35 are run by the Social Welfare Department or JKM,
mm-hmm.
and 7 are run by NGOs, and one of them is WAO's shelter. So, you know, going back to what you had mentioned earlier, the Council of Europe set the minimum standard for shelters to be one family place in a woman's shelter per 10,000 inhabitants. So this is what they call the minimum standard. And they have another aspirational standard. So ideally, you would want to have at least one family place in a woman's shelter per 7,500 inhabitants.
Wow.
So that's the ideal, right? But in Malaysia, WAO estimates that we only have about one family room per 72,538 inhabitants. So essentially, we are at a rate of 7 times more than what is the minimum best practice internationally.
Okay.
So we have a real need for shelters in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's, I guess, why you did this study, which we're going to talk about after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Tan Hyang Lee. She's the Advocacy and Communications Officer at the Women's Aid Organization. And we're discussing a recent study that was conducted by WAO, which suggests there is an urgent need to increase the quantity and standards of domestic violence shelters in Selangor. And we're going to get to that study after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and in the studio with me today is Tan Hyang Lee. She's an Advocacy and Communications Officer at the Women's Aid Organization, and we're discussing why there is a need for a minimum operating standard for domestic violence shelters in Selangor in particular. And we're doing this, we're talking about this because WAO, with the support of Institute Wanita Berdaya, Selangor, you recently released a study which suggests there is an urgent need to increase the quantity and also the standards of domestic violence shelters in Selangor. What actually prompted this research in the first place?
From our experience, we found that there was a great demand for our shelter, and we were often at over capacity. So we knew through our experience that there seems to be a great need for shelters. And at the same time, we found that very, very few domestic violence survivors were able to get shelters at the government-run shelters. So we you know, knew that there was this need, but we wanted to actually find evidence to really show what exactly is the availability of shelters mm-hmm. in Selangor and KL, as well as what is the need. And our end goal is really to advocate for more funding and resources for domestic violence shelters in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's something interesting that the study actually unveiled was that while NGO shelters are often at or over capacity, I suppose, you know, something that WEO is very familiar with, the JKM run shelters, they are often underutilized, right? So I guess the question is, why are these available government run shelters not being fully utilized by domestic violence survivors?
So one reason is that the social welfare department run shelters require survivors to make a police report. Uh-huh. And what we do know is that not all survivors are willing or ready to make a police report. For many of them, they want to get to a safe place. They want the abuse to stop, but they may not necessarily want the abuser to be locked up in prison, for instance.
Right.
And bearing in mind that, you know, there could also be children involved and so on. Another reason is that the social welfare department shelters are closed shelters, meaning that survivors cannot come and go. They may not, well, they probably won't be able to sustain their existing job because they can't leave the shelter.
Right.
And just imagine, you know, imagine you are, you know, living your life in this particular community and you have your friends, you have your family, you have your work and social obligations, and all of a sudden you are asked to relocate to another place where you essentially can't leave the shelter. So, you know, it basically disrupts someone's lives mm-hmm. when the shelter is closed. And that could be one reason why the social welfare department shelters are underutilized. Another reason is also that the social welfare department shelters are not always specific for domestic violence, meaning that you could have other people living there for a host of other reasons, whether homelessness or being an elder and so on and so forth. So the services that you receive there may not be specifically tailored for the needs of a domestic violence survivor.
I see. Okay. And, you know, just going back to the first reason that you gave, right, do we know why that such restrictions are imposed on, let's say, domestic violence survivors?
I'm not sure as to the the reason, at least the explicit reason, but I would imagine that there's often this perception whereby we believe that making that police report is a very critical step for a survivor to get out of a domestic violence situation.
Right.
But I think from what we have found in our experience is that when you put that requirement there for a survivor, or even you know, immediately float the notion of going to the police and making that police report, for many survivors, they may not yet be ready to do so, and they may then choose not to get further services. So I think ultimately, it's about, you know, listening to what the survivor wants and respecting her decision, whether she wants to make that report or if she needs more time or so on and so forth, and to really understand what she needs and to let her make decisions that are best for her life.
Mm-hmm. Because it sounds quite top down in this situation. But all right, okay. And according to the report, you know, while the 4-year average for domestic violence cases reported to the PDRM, this was from 2013 to 2016, that was about 4,935 cases. But only 38 women survivors on average use shelters run by JKM. So is it what you mentioned earlier? Is that what's causing this discrepancy as far as your...
So those two reasons could be some of the reasons why there's so few survivors actually seeking shelter from JKM. But I think those figures perhaps also suggest that there could be lack of strong referral systems. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at these statistics, as mentioned earlier, you get about, you know, about 5,000 cases of mm-hmm. domestic violence reported to the police each year. And the number of cases that are handled by the social welfare department are on average about 700 cases. So just to recap, about 5,000 cases reported to the police each year. about 700 cases handled by the social welfare department. Out of those 700 cases, about 40 women seeking shelter at the social welfare department, and another 70 women moving to their friends or family's house.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, it shows that very, very few women are actually receiving the support they need, which is, you know, very, very worrying. What's happening to the other close to 4,000 women who are making that police report? So I think it could suggest that perhaps there needs to be stronger referral systems between agencies so that when a woman makes that police report, she is informed that, hey, if you want, you could actually get shelter services from JKM. And if you like, you can make an application for a protection order, which is also something that the social welfare department assists us with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's gaps in the system pretty much, right? Okay, and something else that the study also found was that shelters, they vary widely in their intake criteria, services provided, security standards, and even quality. You've mentioned, I think, some of those, but I mean, can you help unpack what that means, especially for a survivor?
Mm-hmm. So the range of services offered at shelters vary quite greatly. So, I mean, the range of services that could potentially be offered in a shelter could include counselling services, social work. So social work means that, you know, we assist a survivor if she wants to make that police report, to get medical care from the hospital, if she wants, you know, to take action against the perpetrator, you know, going through the entire court process. Mm. And it goes right up to figuring out how she can, you know, get and sustain a source of income. So it's very comprehensive case management. And that's what we call social work. So other services that a survivor, you know, could potentially get would be legal aid or information, mm-hmm. financial assistance, as well as skills training and job placements. I mean, these are all the potential options, right? But I mean, because of resource constraints, not all shelters are able to offer this full range of services. So it really depends on what the funding is like for individual shelters.
Mm-hmm. So let's say the government ones, is even those vary in that sense, how much funding they receive?
I'm not exactly sure as to how, you know, if there are any variations across government shelters.
Okay, all right, sure. And, you know, do we actually know where survivors go after they have sought help from the police? I mean, or JKM, or the NGOs, you know, like once they've reached out to you, do we actually have statistics of what happens to them after?
We don't actually have consistent statistics which are collected, you know, across different agencies, which is actually one of our recommendations from the report.
True.
But I think just looking at the number of police reports versus the number of cases handled by the social welfare department, as well as the number of women who actually seek shelter, that already shows there is a great discrepancy. And bearing in mind that 5,000 cases reported to the police is probably just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, of course.
There are probably thousands and thousands more which are not reported, and we don't know what's happening in those cases.
Mm-hmm. So there's some severe gaps that really mm-hmm. need to be addressed. And, you know, I've heard that domestic abusers, they commonly sabotage a survivor's economic stability, right? So it's a form of financial abuse, I think, something that we've spoken mm-hmm. about before as well. Does that actually cause survivors of domestic violence to have trouble finding access to, let's say, affordable housing after they've reached out to the shelters, you know, because these are only short term, for example, right? So does this impact their long term security?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a common tactic for an abuser to control a woman by inhibiting her ability to work or to gain a source of income. So, I mean, the one example would be not allowing her to work. Mm. And there are also more subtle forms of financial abuse whereby a perpetrator may sabotage a woman's career by perhaps, you know, repeatedly harassing her at her office. And as a result, it could jeopardize her job. We also have had cases where a perpetrator had taken up loans in the survivor's name saddling her with lots of debt. So even after she leaves the situation, she still has all these debt to repay. Mm-hmm. Other examples is that we have had cases of women who have professional careers, but her bank account and her ATM card you know, these are all controlled by the abusive partner.
That's tragic.
Yeah, so because she doesn't have financial, some kind of financial means, it's often quite hard for her to, you know, leave that situation. So when she's financially dependent, and especially when there are kids in the picture, it becomes even harder for her to leave that abusive relationship.
Yeah, so that whole act of leaving, I mean, that's such a difficult decision, and it's such a strong decision to make, isn't it? And I mean, that's why shelters are so important. You know, they're like this, like a stopgap somewhere that they can go to kind of assess things, which is why we really need these standards in place. So one thing that the report also unearthed was that all of the shelters interviewed, I think you mentioned this, they operate under resource constraints. So is that just in terms of monetary, or is that other things as well?
So there are different facets to resource constraints. So one of them will be space. So, you know, many shelters are at overcapacity, so they lack space. Second would be they lack human resources to actually man and run the shelter, and to provide, you know, more comprehensive services. And the third will be funding. And just to give you a sense of how much it costs to run a shelter, based on our study, we found that the average operating budget for the shelters that we interviewed in KL and Selangor had an operating budget of about 450,000 per year. So shelters are very, very resource intensive. And as you can imagine, it costs a lot to rent a place, to, you know, pay for the upkeep, staffing services, and so on and so forth. And in terms of the range of operating budget, it ranged from about 180,000 per year to about 1 million per year. So this is based on all the shelters we interviewed in KL and Selangor. Okay. So shelters are very resource intensive, and the problem is that there's not a lot of government funding for shelters. So a lot of, especially the NGO shelters, are run through public donations and grants and CSR funding. And if you think about it, it really should be the government's obligation to provide shelters for women in the country. And, you know, in comparison, if you look at Queensland, Australia, which has a population comparable to Selangor, they have a total of about 60 million of state funding to address homelessness among domestic violence and family violence survivors. So that's 60 million per year in the state of Queensland. And if you look at state funding in Queensland for all domestic violence and family violence programs, so including shelter, but also including other services, it amounts to about 300 million ringgit. So, you know, other countries are putting a lot of money to address domestic violence, but in Malaysia, it seems that there's a lack of government funding for this. And I think it's important to also, you know, look at why. I mean, of course, beyond the obvious, whereby we know that domestic violence is incredibly dangerous. There is a UN report even suggesting that an overwhelming number of homicide women victims were murdered by their intimate partner. So, I mean, just think about it. The home can be the most dangerous place for a woman, and a woman is most likely to be murdered by her intimate partner. So, I mean, this is the obvious reasons, right? But, you know, beyond these reasons, domestic violence really can lead to a host of social issues, from poverty to poor education attainment. So going back to poverty, financial abuse is very common in a domestic violence situation. And, you know, women's ability to work and earn their own income is really inhibited by the violence she faces. So if we want to address poverty in our country, we must look at domestic violence, because it is one of the factors affecting women's economic situation. And in a case of domestic violence, oftentimes the children's ability to study is severely affected. Imagine, you know, moving, you know, if you are trying to flee an abuser, you may be moving around. So you need to transfer schools, your education is interrupted. And of course, not to even mention the mental health impact and trauma from witnessing the violence. So, you know, domestic violence really is lurking beneath many of the social issues that we are trying to address. So this is why we need government funding to address domestic violence.
Once, let's say a domestic violence survivor has left the shelter, you know, is there a process in place to follow up on them just to see how they're doing or whether they've managed to sort of get back on their feet as such?
So in WAO, when a woman is about to check out from our shelter, we would ask her if she wants to continue to be in touch with us. Mm-hmm. And if she says yes, then we would follow up via text or phone calls or even face-to-face if needed. And we would also ask her what further social work support she may need. So, even after the woman leaves the shelter, she may still have an ongoing court case, for instance. Mm. So we still continue providing that social work support until a woman says that she's, fine and she can,
she's okay.
Yeah, she's okay. And not all our clients are live-in clients. So we also have live-out clients. So the social work is provided, regardless of whether she stays in or out the shelter.
Okay, all right. But we don't quite know what's happening in the other shelters, though. We don't know if there's a process in place as such.
Yeah, I imagine that most will have their own policies and their ability to really continue following up depends on their own policies as well as the funding they do receive.
Okay. And, one area that the study pointed out, which was of very urgent concern, is that all shelters noted that at least some of their former residents returned to their abusive husbands or families after leaving the shelters. I mean, that's really quite horrendous for me to hear that. So, I mean, from past case studies that you know of, do we know why that happens?
So actually, it's quite common for a domestic violence survivor to return to the perpetrator. And the research shows that on average, it takes about 7 tries before a survivor actually leaves. I mean, these are research done in other countries. And what we do need to understand is that domestic violence often happens in a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So after a violent incident, that's often what we call as the honeymoon phase. So, initially a perpetrator may, minimize or deny the abuse, and then, he may act, he may become remorseful and start apologizing. But in many cases, the honeymoon period is a honeymoon period. So after that, you would then see the abuse escalating.
Mm.
So to understand why a woman, returns to the perpetrator, it's important for us to understand the cycle of violence. So that's one reason. Another reason could also be that, so when it comes to domestic violence, it's quite common also for a woman to, withdraw her police report.
Yeah.
And one reason is that, when a woman chooses to leave that situation, her safety risk actually goes up. And she may be receiving a lot of threats to her safety from the perpetrator. So he may be threatening to harm her, to harm her children, or to perhaps even threaten to kill her. So, because of this threats, a survivor may feel compelled to, return to a situation.
Mm.
So there are many factors that are resulting in a survivor going back. And I think it's important for us not to judge a survivor. But what's important is to offer support so she knows that she can always come back to the shelter and she will not be turned away.
Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I think I was reading in the report that of the shelters, some actually don't accept returnees. Is that correct?
So some don't accept returnees, which can be another hindrance. I mean, ultimately, the message that we want to tell survivors is that we're always here for you regardless. Mm-hmm. And you can always come back to safety.
Do we know why that policy is in place or not accepting returnees?
I'm not sure, actually. Okay, I think it depends on individual shelters.
Okay. I mean, this is something in the report that really troubled me. Of the shelters who do accept returnees, two point to recurring violence as a factor, right? And as the survivors, again, require protection. But one shelter actually actively pursues family reconciliation as an ideal outcome for survivors. And upon leaving, former residents are generally, again, not allowed back into the shelter. I mean, that doesn't sound to me, at least, like it is putting the woman's best interests first. It's looking for like a very easy sort of, let's all be harmonious and ignore. That's what it sounds like to me. But I mean, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it, you know, comes back to us needing to respect a woman's decisions and to not impose our own perceived solutions on her.
Yeah.
So it's about, you know, ensuring that she has the information she needs to make good decisions, that she has good options to begin with, because sometimes she has, you know, little, if any, options. So firstly, she needs to have those information, that she needs to have good options, viable options that are long-term, right? And then to have that support system where she knows that someone has her back. And I think if these are in place, then, you know, we need to trust survivors to make decisions for themselves. And bearing in mind that we don't fully understand someone else's situation. I mean, we know a little bit, but it's probably the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, because a woman knows her situation best, she is best positioned to make a decision for herself. And even when it comes to choosing to leave a domestic violence situation, we need to ensure that the decision really must come from the woman herself. And she needs to be ready. And then, you know, when she's ready, then she'll make that decision for herself.
So, you know, the study that you guys did, right, there were some recommendations from it that, you know, you hope will help improve the situation. Maybe you can just help me walk through those.
So the first one pertains to funding and budget, which we think is one of the biggest obstacles to providing adequate shelter services. So we believe that there needs to be clear budget lines in the annual federal and state budget. So we believe that there should be co-funding from federal and state government for the setting up of shelters, then there should be clear budget line, meaning that it shouldn't just be this one lump sum to address so-called women's issues.
Right.
So if we think that violence against women is a priority, then put a clear budget line saying that we allocate X ringgit to services, so not just shelters, but also social work services, legal aid, programs to allow women to, you know, get a source of income and get back on their feet, as well as training for service providers for domestic violence survivors. So we need, clear budget lines in the state and federal budget. And we could also explore, you know, ways, you know, innovative ways to fund such services. So, you know, it could even include your zakat, wakaf, and maybe even crowdfunding for setting up shelters. Mm-hmm. So that's the first recommendation. The second recommendation is that we need to have standard statistical data sets for government agencies and NGOs. So this allows us then to compare data across agencies. So going back to your question, you know, what's happening to the survivors after they make that police report or after they seek shelter? So if there is some standardized data sets, then we can then make that comparison and figure out what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And critically important as well is to provide funding to collect data. Because I think a lot of organizations, especially those at the front lines, they are already so stretched trying to provide services, which are, you know, urgent, right?
Yeah.
Critical. And there's not a lot of funding to then, you know, collect the data and to analyze them. And, you know, even the social welfare department, you know, they do need, you know, more funding as well. Even the unit within the police force that's handling domestic violence, they are in great need of more resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second point. Again, just to recap, having standardized statistical data sets. The third recommendation is to have greater coordination and communication across agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have proposed the setting up of a multi-stakeholder committee at the federal, state and district level to coordinate the response to domestic violence. And we are very pleased that the government has, you know, already established this committee. And the reason why coordination is so important in domestic violence cases is that unlike many other crimes, there is so many different stakeholders involved. I mean, if you compare domestic violence to, say, burglary, I mean, in the case of burglary, there are less stakeholders and less agencies that are required. For domestic violence, you know, it's not just the police, it's also the social welfare department and the hospitals and the schools and the courts and the Attorney General's chambers, NGOs, you know, it's so many different stakeholders, and therefore there's a need to ensure there is better collaboration and coordination. And we're very pleased that this stakeholder committee has now been set up. The fourth is that there needs to be more training for shelter providers. So not all shelters are exclusive to domestic violence survivors. So they may be receiving, you know, cases. And it's important for those who are, you know, who are taking the records of the residents to also ask about, you know, the exposure to domestic violence at the point of intake.
That's right.
And the fifth recommendation is to have survivor-centered shelter standards so that there is more consistency in terms of the quality of shelter that survivors receive.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important, right? Survivor-centered rather than society-centered as such.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are wonderful recommendations. I guess what is the hope for this study, essentially?
I mean, our hope is really that policymakers see, you know, domestic violence as a priority to fund and to look into, and more specifically to really see the dire need for shelters in Malaysia. I mean, if you just to, you know, go back to the statistics, I do think it's really concerning that so few survivors.
Yeah.
And just to recap, I think it's worth, you know, reiterating that, you know, we have about 5,000 domestic violence cases a year reported to the police.
These are just the reported
just
ones.
Just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And only about 40 women domestic violence survivors getting shelter from the government. And if you compare, you know, Women's Aid Organization, we are sheltering about 90 women domestic violence survivors per year. So that's actually more than the government. And we are one shelter. So, you know, if we care about women, then we need to fund the shelters to ensure that they are safe so that women can sleep in peace at night.
Yeah. And, you know, not to restrict their movements and, you know, to place such limitations on them, because I guess that might eventually force them into homelessness, for example, or which, again, you know, jeopardizes their safety, jeopardizes their mental health. They're even more vulnerable possibly than when they were at home. So there's a lot of change that needs to happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, it also goes back to how we view the people we are serving, in this case, domestic violence survivors. I think if we, you know, respect women's autonomy, if we respect their ability to make decisions over their lives, then we would try to provide solutions that increases their ability to be mobile, to make decisions and to be autonomous. And another reason why it's so important is that in a domestic violence situation, your ability to make decisions over your life is taken away by the perpetrator. You're essentially controlled. You have no voice and no say. So when a woman leaves an abusive situation, we should not replicate that same system of control and micromanaging. So as far as possible, of course, we need to balance safety risks and so on.
Of course.
But, you know, our intention should really be to ensure that she has autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but you know, if anybody would like to get more information about the study or about the work that the Women's Aid Organization does, you know, how best can they do that?
So you can log on to our website, wao.org.my, and our research is available on our website. And if you do need any support for domestic violence, or if you know someone who needs support, you can also get in touch with us. We have a hotline as well as an SMS WhatsApp line. And if you'd like to get the numbers, you can just go to our website, wao.org.my.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I've been speaking to Tan Hyang Lee. She's an advocacy and communications officer at the Women's Aid Organization. And we were discussing why there is an urgent need for a minimum operating standards for domestic violence shelters, specifically here in Selangor, but I think that will probably go across Malaysia as well, right? And if you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.